Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of our Finals Countdown series, which is as always brought to you by MedTalks. Now in this series we are providing all of you wonderful medical students, in other words the future of our healthcare, that's right guys, a lot of responsibility, with short, succinct and super useful revision talks for your upcoming exams and for beyond as life as doctors. As you should already know, if you don't know, then you'll get to know, we are currently in the endocrinology section of our revision series, and in the previous episodes we've looked at diabetes mellitus, and we've covered the two main types, that's type 1 and type 2. We've also looked at diabetic ketoacidosis, which can very often be a presenting feature of type 1 diabetes, and it's also a very known, well-known complication of mainly type 1 diabetes. In this episode, we're going to cover the main complications of diabetes in general, and we'll look at acute and chronic complications. I hope you've been enjoying this series so far. Please remember to give us your feedback. We'd love to hear your thoughts, and we'd love to answer any questions that you have. You can get in touch with different ways. You can message us on Instagram. Our Instagram is medtalks.uk. You can email us at hellomedtalks@gmail.com. Or if you listen via the Apple Podcast platform, you can leave a review and rate us out of 5 stars. So, in today's episode, we're looking at acute and chronic complications of diabetes. All right, let's get started. So we've already covered diabetic ketoacidosis in a separate episode, and these are all available, guys, completely for free at just the press of a button. So if you're on the go, they're really useful to listen to as just some additional revision. So we've looked at diabetic ketoacidosis. We've also looked at hypoglycemia, another well-known complication of diabetes. And the acute complication that I want to focus on today is hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state, or HHS, which mainly occurs in patients with type 2 diabetes. And we're going to talk about what HHS is, how it is defined, the clinical features, the pathophysiology, how it's diagnosed, and then we'll talk about the management and the complications. And after we've covered that, we'll touch on some of the chronic complications of diabetes. So, HHS, it's essentially characterized by high blood glucose levels. And now when I say high, I mean really high. And often it's above 40 millimoles per liter, which is just crazy high. And typically it develops secondary to a combination of an illness, so an infection, also dehydration, and an inability to take normal diabetes medications because of the effects of the illness. So in HHS, we've got severe hyperglycemia, so often the levels above 40. We've got marked serum hyperosmolarity, and I'll talk more about this shortly. We don't have any significant ketosis, which is what we have in diabetic ketoacidosis, and it is a life-threatening emergency. So there's no precise definition of HHS, but the main features that differentiate it from other hyperglycemic states such as DKA are a hypovolemia, so a low blood volume, marked hyperglycemia, so that's 30 millimoles per liter or more, without any significant hyperketonemia, so it's less than 3 millimoles per liter, or without any acidosis, so that's a pH is greater than 7.3 and the bicarbonate is greater than 15. And remember, these are the signs that we look out for in DKA. And also the osmolality is usually 320 milliosmoles per kilogram or more. And again, I'll touch on this osmolarity and osmolality shortly. So as I said before, it's mainly occurs in type 2 diabetics in the older patients, and the DKA occurs in the type 1 diabetics in younger patients. Previously, this HHS was called hyperglycemic hyperosmolar non-ketotic coma. But this was then altered because most of the patients did not actually present in a comatose state, but they just presented it very, very unwell. So what are some of the risk factors for developing HHS? Well, as I said, it's mainly in older people who have type 2 diabetes. Other risk factors are residents of a nursing home or patients who live alone, patients with a background of dementia, patients who are taking sedative drugs such as benzodiazepines or things like gabapentin, patients who are at a high risk of developing infections, so patients on steroids, or if they're immunosuppressed for whatever reason, such as HIV, or if they have a malignancy or are on chemotherapy. Also, children who are on long-term steroid use are at an increased risk. Now, HHS doesn't just happen. It has to be caused by something. And one of the common causes is an intercurrent or coexisting illness, which could be an infection, so a pneumonia or a urinary tract infection or sepsis from somewhere, so cellulitis or a dental infection or abscess. Other conditions that can precipitate HHS include a myocardial infarction or potentially a stroke or some kind of intracranial hemorrhage, hyper or hypothermia, something in the intestine, so intestinal ischemia or infarction, pancreatitis, a pulmonary embolism, acute kidney injury or a decompensated chronic kidney disease, any cause of acute abdomen such as an appendicitis or a cholecystitis or a perforation of the bowel, hormonal changes or hyperthyroidism, a burn, gastrointestinal bleeding, and also Cushing syndrome. So all of these can potentially precipitate HHS. Okay, so that brings me on to look at the pathophysiology that is behind HHS. And essentially, it's pretty much a lack of insulin, which is then coupled with a rise in the counter-regulatory hormones. So those are cortisol, growth hormone, and glucagon, which then leads to a significant and profound rise in glucose. Now, patients with HHS, they do retain a certain amount of insulin, which prevents them going on to develop ketosis, and that's what differentiates it from DKA. But the level of insulin that they have is insufficient to prevent the rise in serum glucose. And this rise in serum glucose leads to a massive osmotic diuresis within the kidneys. And we lose essential electrolytes from our bloodstream, such as sodium and potassium. We also are losing a lot of water. And because of this water loss, it leads to profound dehydration, reduced circulating volume or hypovolemia, and that leads to something called hyperosmolarity and the hyperglycemia. So sometimes patients can actually have up to 9 liters deficit of water. So what is this osmolarity and osmolality? Well, they are often confused between each other and frequently interchanged. The osmolarity refers to the number of solute particles per 1 liter of solvent, whereas the osmolality is the number of solute particles in 1 kilogram of solvent. Now, in HHS, we have hyperosmolarity, which is basically means that we have a high number of solute particles per 1 liter of solvent. And that's because we have marked dehydration and marked hypovolemia. So patients are very sick and they're very dehydrated. Now, the profound increase in osmolarity and osmolality leads to compensatory mechanisms such as the release of antidiuretic hormone or ADH and the stimulation of thirst, but it can't compensate for the water loss from the kidneys, which leads to hypovolemia, and this can then lead to an acute kidney injury, electrolyte derangement, hypotension, and potentially a coma. Also, the hyperosmolar state of this condition can lead to hyperviscosity, which then increases the risk of thrombi, so that could be in the arteries or the veins, such as a stroke or a DVT. So that's the pathophysiology behind HHS. Now let's move on to the clinical features. So we'll look at the signs and the symptoms that patients may exhibit. Okay, now guys, just imagine you are in A&E or you're on the ward, you're at the end of the bed and you're looking at a patient who's got HHS. How are they going to look? Just have a think about how they might look from the end of the bed. Well, based on what we've spoken about before, on general inspection, they're going to look pretty ill. They're going to look absolutely exhausted. They may be disorientated and confused. They're likely going to have signs of dehydration because of this significant hypovolemia. And the things to look out for would be a dry mouth, cool peripheries, reduced skin turgor, and a capillary refill of greater than 2 seconds. They may have sunken eyes on general inspection. In terms of their observations at the bedside, a tachycardia is likely because of the dehydration and possibly a hypotension because of this severe fluid depletion or even due to the underlying infection and sepsis. They may have increased respiratory rate, which could be a compensatory attempt to reduce the metabolic acidosis. And a temperature check may show a high temperature, so pyrexia or hypothermia. Now, examination of the skin is definitely important to look for any obvious source of infections from the skin, such as cellulitis or leg ulcers. Again, reduced turgor due to the dehydration. If they've got a temperature, they might feel clammy, warm, moist, but severe sepsis can lead to cold, dry, mottled skin because of this reduced peripheral perfusion. Look at their eyes. They may have sunken eyes. They may have a very dry mouth and dry mucous membranes. And a quick screening of the cranial nerves can reveal some visual field defects, any nystagmus or other cranial nerve palsies. You can have a feel of the neck, check for any enlarged lymph nodes, any neck stiffness, which may be secondary to meningitis. Listen to the chest to look for any signs of pneumonia, so crackles or acute respiratory distress syndrome. Cardiac examination might reveal heart failure as a precipitant, or ECG might show evidence of myocardial infarction with ST or T wave changes, or even infective endocarditis with a new murmur. Examine the abdomen to look for any acute abdominal findings, so abdominal tenderness, signs of peritonism with rebound tenderness or guarding, and also a neurological examination to check their orientation, to calculate their GCS and examine their upper and lower limbs, do a full neurological examination. So once you've done that, so once you examine them, you've got your history and you've got some investigation results, then diagnoses are usually quite clear. Now, it's always important to consider differential diagnoses, and these could be things like poisoning or overdose, which can produce metabolic derangement and a bit of disorientation. Older patients can present with delirium, and this is the main differential at first assessment. In terms of symptoms, patients may have symptoms of diabetes, such as polydipsia, polyuria. They may also have things like nausea and vomiting, may have muscle cramps because of electrolyte derangements. They may have an altered mental status and a coma, and also can sometimes present with seizures. But this will be very late on stage in the condition. Hey guys, just a quick one. If you, like me, are iPad lovers and spend all of your productive time on your iPads making notes for exams or making notes for anything else, then I cannot recommend enough the paper-like screen protector. The number of times I've scratched my unprotected iPad screen after using different styluses or styli, but since having the paper-like screen protector, it's kept my screen extremely well shielded. Its nanodot surface technology provides a better tactile feel, increased stroke friction, and minimal light diffraction so that making art and taking notes on an iPad feels as natural as writing on paper. Made for the iPad and Apple Pencil, Paperlight delivers the unforgettable feeling of real paper into your digital workspace. To find out more about this wonderful creation, you can just head on over to their website by searching paperlight.com/medtalks, and I will leave this link in the episode description so you can have a look after you've listened to the episode. And if you are interested in purchasing a Paperlight screen protector, then please do enter the code MEDTALKS at the checkout page, and again I will leave that all in the episode description. Okay, back to the episode. Okay, so it's getting juicy now. Moving on to the investigations and how we're going to diagnose this. So we've got our clinical features, we've got our examination findings. The immediate things we need to do, we need to check the capillary glucose, and this will come back above 30 millimoles per litre. It's also wise to do a serum glucose, and again, this will confirm the diagnosis. A serum osmolality will be greater than 320 milliosmoles per kilogram, or even a serum osmolarity can be done, and this will be per litre. The normal is about 290 plus or minus 5, and this can obviously vary according to the person. And then we need to check the ketones to make sure it's not DKA, so that in the blood it will be less than 3 millimoles per litre, and in the urine there may be a trace or it may be negative. Now, the plasma osmolality, if we can't get a result straight away, we can actually calculate it ourselves using a formula, and the formula is osmolality equals 2 times sodium, the sodium level, so that could be from a venous blood gas or from the urea and electrolyte sample that we do have, plus the urea, so again that would be from the U's and E's that we've sent off, plus the glucose. So 2 times the sodium plus the urea plus the glucose. Other tests that we would need to do, firstly to kind of find out what the cause is, so things like an ECG to check for any evidence of myocardial infarction, urinalysis to look for a UTI, a urinary pregnancy test, and then your basic blood test to look for infection and potential causes, so fluid blood count, urine, electrolytes, a CRP, liver function test, blood cultures, troponin and amylase to look for any pancreatitis, and a CK, so creatine kinase. In terms of imaging, we do a chest x-ray and a CT head, especially if there's any focal neurology or reduced GCS. So sometimes the precipitant might be obvious, such as a myocardial infarction on an ECG or a urinalysis that's positive for infection, but we do have to do a full workup to find out what's going on with these patients. And then that brings me on to how we're going to manage these patients. And the goals of treatment are correcting the dehydration, correcting the hyperglycemia and the hyperosmolality, correcting the electrolyte derangement, and identifying and treating what the precipitating event is. If we do not optimally manage the plasma sodium concentration and plasma osmolality, then it can lead to two rare and potentially life-threatening complications, such as cerebral edema and osmotic demyelination syndrome. We also want to treat it because we're avoiding hyperviscosity within the vessels, so we want to avoid thrombi, so arterial venous. And so the initial measures are essentially resuscitation via the A to E approach. Patients who have deteriorating oxygen saturations will need to be discussed with ITU and anesthetics, and they may need intubation and ventilation. They need wide, large bore cannulae, both sides, ECG monitoring, SATS monitoring, blood pressure monitoring, oxygen if required. They need to be catheterized to obtain their urine and monitor the output. If they have impaired consciousness, then they may need to have an NG tube passed, and they need to be transferred to a high dependency area because these guys are very sick and they need close monitoring. And the acute medical and all the diabetic team need to be alerted. Now, the main principles with regards to treatment, we need to measure, we need to calculate the osmolality frequently to monitor the response to treatment. These patients are so dehydrated, they need fluid stat. So IV crystalloids, such as 0.9% sodium chloride, is a principal fluid to restore circulating volume and reverse this dehydration. Not only will it reverse the dehydration, but it will also bring down the blood glucose. But the glucose should not fall more than 5 millimoles per litre per hour. And a low-dose intravenous insulin can be commenced once the blood glucose is no longer falling with IV fluids alone, or immediately if there is significant ketonemia. So the IV fluid replacement aims to achieve a positive balance, so positive fluid balance of 3 to 6 litres by 12 hours, and then remaining replacement of estimated fluid losses within the next 12 hours. Patients should also be encouraged to drink as soon as it is safe to do so. So as long as they're not, as long as their consciousness is not impaired or they're not at risk of aspiration, and we need strict input and output monitoring for these patients. We also need to treat any underlying and precipitating causes. They need to be put on prophylactic anticoagulation because of what I mentioned before about the hyperviscosity. Now, electrolytes need to be very closely monitored, particularly sodium, potassium, and also phosphate and magnesium, so about 4 hourly, and they need to be replaced as necessary. The potassium monitoring is particularly important if patients started on insulin, because insulin can drive the potassium into cells and cause a reduction in the serum potassium concentration, which can cause arrhythmias. So as a general rule for potassium, if the serum potassium is more than 5.5, then we don't need to give any replacement. If it's between 3.5 to 5.5, then they need 40 millimoles potassium replacement if they're on insulin. And if the serum potassium is less than 3.5, then a senior review needs to be considered for more invasive potassium replacement. Now, patients are going to be receiving a lot of fluids, and this is for the dehydration, and we need to be careful and monitor them for signs of fluid overload, so going the other way. So looking out for any peripheral edema or any new oxygen requirement and any crackles in the lungs if this happens. And caution must be taken with the very elderly and frail patients, and also patients with any background of heart failure or renal failure. So the fluids should be slower, given more slowly than they would to patients without heart or renal failure. Now, if the patients have been started on a fixed rate insulin infusion at about 0.05 units per kilogram per hour, then it shouldn't be stopped until the plasma glucose levels are within target range and the patient's over the acute episode. If they are still not tolerating oral intake, they can be changed to a variable rate intravenous insulin infusion or a sliding scale in this interim period. And once they are tolerating oral intake, so they're not vomiting, then they can be switched back to their normal insulin. Okay, now finally, I'll just touch on some of the complications of HHS. So it is an acute life-threatening emergency with a number of associated complications to both the disease process and treatment. So complications include myocardial infarction, so the reduced blood volume, hypovolemia, the hyperviscosity, and the severe illness can put some strain on the heart. And in those patients who have pre-existing coronary disease, this can increase the risk of a myocardial infarction. Also, I mentioned the hyperviscosity. This can predispose patients to forming blood clots. This could be arterial or a venous thrombus. So things like a DVT, a P, or a stroke, and they have to be put on prophylactic enoxaparin or dalteparin, whatever is used in the hospital, to reduce this risk. And Probably the most concerning and the rarest complication is cerebral edema, which can occur from a rapid correction of the hyperglycemia, which then leads to a rapid drop in the plasma osmolarity and can lead to cerebral edema, which then can present with a headache, reduced GCS, and if it's not treated, it can lead to death. HHS does have a higher mortality rate than DKA. It's about 10 times higher than the mortality rate in patients with DKA. How can it be prevented? Well, patients who have diabetes need to be taught how to manage their condition, particularly when they're ill, and also to seek medical advice when they feel unwell, which would then lead to earlier recognition of the issues. Patients need to be made aware about the possibility of developing HHS and how to avoid it. Right, guys, I think I'll leave this there. As promised, we've looked into the condition HHS, or hyperosmolar hyperglycemic state. Now, this is a complication mainly of type 2 diabetes, and it's a potentially life-threatening emergency. We've looked at what HHS is, how it's defined, how it presents, the pathophysiology, the clinical features, the investigations that we need to do, how we treat patients with HHS, and some of the complications, and we've looked at prevention as well. As always, I hope you've enjoyed this episode and found it useful. Please remember to share them with your friends, your peers, and anyone else who may find them useful. Also, we'd love to hear your feedback. Get in touch with us on Instagram. You can email us hellomedtalks@gmail.com. You can check out all of our other episodes, which are available completely for free on podcast platforms such as Apple, Spotify, and Google. If you haven't already done so, go and check those out. And we look forward to bringing you lots more content in the next episode. We will be looking at some of the chronic complications of diabetes. So stay tuned. Thanks for listening, guys. Goodbye.